Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. You know, there are some days when I wish, rather than kind of formally introducing the show, when the news break is over, we could just open the microphones. Because on days like this, when we have such great panels, we've already started, I think, some really interesting conversations that we're going to start all over again because you deserve to hear some of the things we're talking about today. Joining me, of course, it's Monday, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You most of the time you read them on Wednesdays and Sundays, but you got a day off yesterday.
Yeah. I got just because of the aftermath of the mayoral election, we're back on the normal schedule now.
All right. So we'll see you again on Wednesday. Do you have a preview? You know what you're writing about for Wednesday?
I do, but I can't talk about it right now.
Oh, okay. Fine. Then we'll just pick up the paper and read it. You also read his byline, Greg Bluestein, Tamar Hallerman, and others in Politically Georgia, the blog on the MyAJC, the political blog on the MyAJC website. Also joining us today, Loretta Lepore. Loretta was communications director for Governor Sonny Perdue, Republican Governor Sonny Perdue. She was the co-chair of the Carly Fiorina presidential campaign in Georgia last year, and she does a lot of government relations work, a lot of it around transportation issues. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You got through the storm all right on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, I sure did. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was a lot of fun, but I didn't lose power, so I understand.
Well, I didn't either. Yes, that's right. It's easy for us to say.
Brian Robinson lost power.
I did.
At least electrical power at his home, but Brian, a Republican strategist, former communications director for Governor Nathan Deal, never, ever gives up the other kind of power.
That's right. I would have gladly given up anything to get some electricity on Friday night and Saturday morning. I had a one-year-old huddled by a fire all night on Friday. It was not a pleasant experience.
Well, I'm glad everything's okay at your house now. And we're joined by former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden of Cobb County. Buddy, I want you to know that people have already tweeted messages to you. West Rome alumni says, "Hi, Uncle Buddy!" Exclamation point. Todd Reams, nickname for you. Some people just can't give it up.
Yes, backed by popular demand, I'm here.
Uncle Buddy, let's start with a couple of interesting breaking news stories. One of them is that we've now had a federal court that has denied a Trump administration request to delay the order requiring the military to begin accepting transgender recruits starting January 1st. So to back this up, Jim, of course, President Trump tweeted an order some time ago saying no more transgender members of the armed services. Courts, or rather his own military staff, his Joint Chiefs of Staff and others said, no, we're going to continue this. And now this matter has gotten to the point where the courts are saying, look, there's no reason in the world to delay anything that we're going to continue to allow transgendered individuals.
Right, right. Generally, in a case like this, what a judge will look at is who is damaged by the delay.
Yes.
And in this point, he's saying the federal government is not damaged by this delay, but the potential recruits, transgender persons who want to have a military career, they could be damaged by this. So it's telling them go ahead. You get the impression that the Pentagon was never too keen on the order that came out of the White House. There was that first tweet, and then I believe there was a formal White House generated order that came out.
Yes.
But
yes.
You get the impression that the Pentagon has never been fully on board with that.
Jim, what happened, as you recall, is that there was pushback from the Pentagon saying, well, we're not going to do this until we get a direct order from the commander-in-chief. And there was a several-week delay, and then finally he did issue a direct order. And this is the appeal from that direct order, which apparently the federal court sees as harming the transgender people and the government not being harmed.
All right, so we're going to watch how this proceeds in court. It still awaits court action down the line, but at this point, transgender individuals will still be welcome to serve in and presumably to join United States military services. Another story that I think we're all just trying to absorb because there's a lot to it, but we should at least mention a headline, and I'd love to have all of you who have gotten more, maybe more of a chance than I have to look at it. The Washington Post, excuse me, about an hour and a half before we went on the air, moved a story themselves. In other words, it's their reporting. And I'll just read the lead. After 5 months in office, President Trump's new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been unable to divest financial holdings that pose potential conflicts of interest, hindering her ability to fully perform her job. That story is particularly relevant, Loretta, to us here in Georgia, because the CDC chief is Brenda Fitzgerald, who was a candidate for a public office for Congress back in the 90s, and then went on to work for the State Department of Public Health, run it, and it was Tom... she was Price who wanted her to have that CDC's job. So it's a story that has relevance to us here.
Right. She was coming on board to the CDC as Tom Price became embroiled in some of the issues that led to his departure from HHS. And so they almost kind of had like a transition where, you know, now she... There's a lack of leadership in a sense in terms of a secretary at HHS that hasn't yet been approved, though the chief of staff and those other senior members have remained the same and constant. I do know through friends who work at the CDC that Brenda has been very active within the department in terms of meeting with staff. She's had what they call coffee with the commissioner, and staff members could sign up to have coffee with her and hear what her goals were for the department and for her to hear from them what they thought some of the issues were within the CDC. And there's also been some reporting that she's been restructuring the CDC and to make it less siloed and into bigger blocks of like issues to address the public health challenges we're facing today.
Jim, the reporting, and again, I'm just sort of absorbing this story, but one of the things that report, she of course, filed financial disclosure documents, but she pointed out, and I apologize, I'm getting a little hoarse, that she can't divest herself legally from some of her investments. I don't understand the investment world, so I'm not quite sure what that means.
I don't either. But apparently, Patty Murray, the senator from
Washington State, Democratic senator,
wrote a letter to Ms. Dr. Fitzgerald and said, "We are upset that you haven't divested yourself of the interest that she spread out there when she was confirmed."
Yes.
And she is saying it's a lot more difficult than you might think.
It may very well be, but in the meantime, one of the things the Post points out is because of some of these investments, there are certain key issues that CDC is working on, for instance, the opioid crisis, that she's had to step back from and essentially recuse herself.
Right, and I'm not sure what those investments are. I would, however, say that this has tremendous local impact here because the CDC is considered it's not so much a political force as it is an economic attraction.
It's a huge employer.
It's out there paired with Emory University, and it is one of those reasons that this last annexation had taken place. This is the future of Atlanta over the next 20 years that we're talking about.
We're going to have to watch how that unfolds. But, Buddy, as long as you're with us today, we might want to point out that when I said she'd run for office in the past, she actually ran for the seat that you held up there when the 7th District was centered in Cobb County.
That's right. Of course, she's a native and lives down in Carroll County, and she ran against Bob Barr in the Republican primary in 1994 and was unsuccessful. Let me say a word about Dr.
Against you, which would have been against you.
Didn't they do a kind of a tea party? Didn't she and Newt Gingrich dump a whole lot of tea into the Chattahoochee River?
That's exactly right. They sure did.
They did. And however, she was unsuccessful in her race against Bob Barr. And of course, Bob Barr won the primary and then was subsequently elected to the seat that I formerly held. But let me say this about Dr. Fitzgerald. I happen to know, and I can't go too far here without saying something improper. I happen to know that she went to a lot of time and effort and a lot of care to see that she complied with the law. This is a very difficult kind of situation here, and just because a senator's made some allegations or written a letter, I think that we ought to step back and withhold judgment here, because it's easy to cast aspersions here in the political environment we're in. And so I would just suggest caution in this area.
Well, and you're absolutely, thank you. And buddy, Brian, yes, that said, there's no question that this attracts more interest because of what we just went through with Tom Price. And Democratic critics particularly, who said that he was investing in medical devices and other medical products that were a direct conflict to his work as HHS secretary.
Well, the charges had to do with him voting as a congressman on issues that could impact his investments, and getting inside information from other congressmen who had perhaps insider trading information.
Right.
But with Brenda, I want to say this. I don't know all the details, but I want to say I worked with her when she was the commissioner of public health on the state level, and we worked together rather closely as we went through the crisis when the what was the disease that coming in from Africa?
Ebola.
Ebola. Yes, I'm sorry. I've whitewashed that from my memory. It was a terrible time. Had to deal with her as we were going through the Ebola crisis, working with CDC. She's never displayed anything but integrity and leadership and competence. And I think we should give her the benefit of the doubt until evidence proves otherwise.
Yeah, the problem is as we were saying when we were off air, is you don't know what kind of backing she has now that the mentor, the fellow who brought her into federal government is now gone.
Well, that's true. My hunch on that, though, Jim, is that the Trump administration already has enough positions that are open to fill. They're not going to look to get rid of her and have to start a search for her.
Yeah, let me freeze that conversation, because I don't want to create a false impression here. And a couple of you have already said it, really. This is a new story, just broke. We're still absorbing it. I don't think there's any suggestion that this is a crisis yet at this point for Brenda Fitzgerald. Is it could it potentially get worse for her? Possibly. Who knows? But I want to stop that.
Well, and it's not that she hasn't been fully transparent,
exactly.
Right? So this was displayed publicly during her confirmation process and in ethics documents and so forth. And she's taken counsel from ethics, from her legal counsel on this. And so it's not as though there was something that was not, she was not forthcoming about.
Well, we'll see if the story develops and it's worthy of a continued conversation here and elsewhere. If you woke up in Alabama this morning and your phone rang, it's possible that you heard this.
Roy Moore is the guy we need to pass our Make America Great Again agenda. Roy is a conservative who helped me steer this country back on track after 8 years of the Obama disaster. Get out and vote for Roy Moore. His vote is our Republican Senate, and it's needed.
Well, Jim?
Well, first of all, number one, robocalls are not the medium where you shout.
Yeah.
shouting is poor form. But to your point, Bill, I think today I think this is the day that everybody woke up in Alabama.
Oh, well, good.
We're all Alabamans today.
That's really true. This is a huge national story. It's also significant for us because they're our next door neighbor. And in a minute, I want to talk about the fact that it also may be important for Georgia in terms of how we do business in competing against Alabama. We'll get to that in a minute, but I see Buddy Darden wants to weigh in.
Absolutely. Let's talk about endorsements, and let's look right back about 2 weeks ago at
all the endorsements. Can we just say before you do, all of this is to say, as if people don't know, tomorrow is the election. Doug Jones, the Democrat, against Roy Moore, the Republican.
I don't see how anybody with a half a brain would not already know that, unless you've been on another continent, you know, for the last 3 months. But let me say this about endorsements. I think we found out in the mayor's race just recently that endorsements don't necessarily carry the day. In fact, sometimes they can even backfire on someone. And there's no one in the world who doesn't know that Donald Trump is not for Roy Moore. At the same time, if Alabamans are going to make their own decisions, they probably will resent, in some cases, the president as well as anybody else making endorsements for one side or another. So I'm not a big believer in endorsements. I never endorsed anybody. One, because the only thing it did was bring my enemies out, you know, against the person I happen to endorse. So I'm not sure it's going to really make any difference in the long run.
Brian, Fox News has a poll they just released which shows Doug Jones, the Democrat, with a 10-point lead over Roy Moore. Virtually every other poll in the state shows Roy Moore up by at least a few points. The explanation for the discrepancy is that Fox News got a lot more cell phones polled than the others. The others are mostly in landline polls, and they got younger people to respond. What do you say about that?
Well, I think any poll worth its salt these days requires some level of cell phone use. Otherwise, you're getting a really skewed sample, and I've heard various theories on which side that benefits. But one thing about skewing toward younger voters is they're the least likely to show up. When you just poll older voters, you're getting a skewed sample, but they're the ones who are going to come hell or high water. They're going to be there at the polls. So I don't see a real strong pathway for Doug Jones because, one, Alabama is overwhelmingly Republican. This is a state that Trump won by more than 25 points at a time when he was winning here in Georgia by the skin of his teeth. I mean, really held to 50%, well below what a Republican would normally get. Two, it's the state where 70% of Republicans don't believe the charges that are being leveled against him as it pertains to young women 40 years ago. And three, in order for Doug Jones, the Democrat, to have a chance, he has got to have extraordinary, through-the-roof African-American turnout paired with white moderates in the suburbs of Montgomery and Birmingham who usually vote Republican. And I saw fascinating polling this morning that where Roy Moore's edge is with high school educated white.
Well, he dated
voters.
All of them? Is that why?
he's got a massive margin there between men and women.
Yeah.
But with college educated whites in Alabama, Doug Jones is winning with those women, which is fascinating. And so that's his path to victory, is those things together. But that's really hard to pull off.
That's a democratic demographic pattern that Roy Moore shares with Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see the direction the party is going there toward a blue collar base. But I want to finish by saying this: there's no evidence anywhere in early voting or in polling, in case studies, I mean, people being in the neighborhoods of the African American community in Alabama being all that interested in voting in this election.
Yeah, I'm going to put a hold for right now. We have a lot more to talk about in terms of this Alabama Senate race. We're also got to get a break in here. So let's do that right now. And when we come back, let's keep talking about what has become the most important election of 2017, I think it's safe to say. And we'll do that after a break. You're listening to Political Rewind.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. And as 2017 comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the independent journalism and all the programs that you hear possible. As you support the organizations that matter to you, please remember how much you rely on GPB. Go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift. And thanks so much for your support.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. There was a buddy, I think it may have been you, said that the Moore supporters are going to show up. They are absolutely energized to go out and vote. Frank Luntz, who has been a longtime, mostly Republican consultant, pollster, by the way, just to put him in a Georgia frame of reference, it was Frank Luntz who advised Newt Gingrich on creating in 1994 his contract for America. So Luntz has people here who've been in politics know Frank Luntz. He conducted a focus group for Vice News on HBO. And I think these are Republicans. He wanted to get to the bottom of how they felt about Roy Moore and why. So we're going to take just a couple minutes and listen to some of that.
How many women have to come forward before you say, wait a minute, where there's smoke, there's fire?
It doesn't matter about it's the legitimacy, not just how many. Exactly. How many are actually not being paid or being coerced to do this?
How many of them do you think are being paid?
All of them.
All of them?
All of them.
By show of hands, how many of you think all the women are being paid? Seriously.
To me, there are only two women that maybe have a smoking gun, but, you know, the women's reputations were questionable at the time. It doesn't sound like it went beyond their still clothes on. It doesn't sound like it went beyond anything, and that as soon as the girl said she wasn't comfortable, he took her home.
I guess my question is, you blame her. She's 14.
I'm not blaming her. I'm blaming both of them. So I didn't say that I thought he was without sin. It's possible he did it, but it's possible that he could be forgiven for... I don't think he raped her.
Let's be real. It was a different world. 40 years ago in Alabama, people could get married at 13 and 14 years old. My grandmother at 13 was married at 15, had two children and a husband and a job. If Roy Moore was guilty, if he was at the mall hitting on this 14-year-old, 40 years ago in Alabama, there's a lot of mamas and daddies that'd be thrilled that their 14-year-old was getting hit on by a district attorney.
Roy Moore is not a miserable man. This man has more integrity than you can find in the entire Congress right now. Don't fall for the George Soros assassination plan. The truth will come out. These women are all going to be proven, just like the 16 that went against President Trump.
Loretta, a lot of female voices in there supporting and defending Roy Moore.
There are. That was hard to swallow.
Is that the Stockholm syndrome that we're seeing?
That, you know, it's pretty amazing to listen to that and think that there are a lot of voters in Alabama who are willing, that you know, are socially conservative. They have been Roy Moore supporters because he is a social conservative, and they're willing, one, to overlook these allegations, but two, they're willing to assert blame elsewhere. So if you were to listen to more of that, you would have heard blame placed on the media. You would have heard blame placed on Gloria Allred for interjecting herself, and potentially that was a misstep.
This is the attorney,
Gloria Allred, for one of the women who is making these allegations against Roy Moore, and the fact that Gloria Allred is, you know, known in a lot of circles as a media gadfly, so it created some distrust. You have the media making some mistakes recently, so there's casting all this blame outside at outside forces, and really rallying cry behind Roy Moore, really, really based on their socially conservative beliefs.
This is, talk about tribalism these days, buddy. Talk about people, you know, uniting it with in their tribe. This is couldn't be a better example of that.
No question about it. However, let me suggest to this group, maybe this is a minority view, but I think that the folks from Alabama have had about enough of Roy Moore, and he's beginning to wear thin. When he ran, of course, for governor, he didn't do very well. He's been removed from office twice as Chief Justice for not following the law. And at what point do the folks of Alabama are going to say, enough. Let's move on. Let's go on somewhere
else. Well, here's one person who said enough. A former colleague of you in the United States House, now a senior senator from Alabama, Richard Shelby.
For me, I said I can't vote for Roy Moore. The state of Alabama deserves better. I think we've got a lot of great Republicans that could have won and carried the state beautifully and served in the Senate honorably.
All right.
And he's as good a politician as I've ever known and reads the tea leaves as well as anybody I know. And if he thought that he were damaging himself by making that statement, I guarantee you he would have never said it.
So you feel that he is looking at this closely and thinks there's a good likelihood that Moore loses, and so he's safe in speaking out against him?
Either he loses or he's damaged goods to the point that he can't do and inflict any harm on Shelby.
Well, I agree with Buddy's point in that I think there probably are, in particular, younger Alabamans that don't have a sort of a distaste for Roy Moore. I guess if that's one way to characterize it, may not be voting for him in this election. The question comes down to, are there enough of those folks who see his candidacy and potentially his election as a detriment to the state of Alabama in terms of economic development, in terms of, you know, Richard Shelby has long been a supporter of their military installations and the BRAC process. And, you know, so there's a lot of other, I think there are a number of Alabamans that see that as, see the jeopardy and the risk in this, and that even if he is elected, it doesn't stop tomorrow. Then you have another process potentially in the U.S. Senate.
And that's precisely where I think this is going. I think we're going to see Roy Moore elected on Tuesday, tomorrow, and at that point, then the economic dominoes start falling. If you're, you know, if you're involved in economic development in Georgia right now, you've got this feeling of Schadenfreude right now. I mean, you kind of like where Alabama's going vis-a-vis where you are going. You've got Georgia sitting right here, in the deep South. On one side is North Carolina, which it had its problems one election cycle before. Alabama is going to go into the tank. If there's any big competition for another automaker, any large manufacturing, Alabama is not going to have the leg up that it once had.
Yeah, you know, Brian, I think that's a really, really, both Loretta and Jim are making awfully strong points. I hearken back to the decision that our earlier leaders made that we were going to put an international airport in Atlanta before Birmingham could do it. And, of course, that led to Atlanta truly becoming the capital of the South in terms of commerce. And now
the fact that we weren't blowing up black churches in Atlanta like they were in Birmingham.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. All right. And yet now we're at another tipping point, perhaps. While Georgia's political leaders and business leaders are rallying to say we can't do anything that discourages Amazon from wanting to choose us as a headquarters, no religious liberty bills if we can avoid them, let's be careful about gun measures, all the other social issues. In Alabama, if you're in Huntsville or Tuscaloosa where we've got auto plants, you've got to be scared to death about what it would mean to have Roy Moore in the United States Senate.
Alabama's loss is Georgia's gain. I think we stand in such a stark contrast to Alabama today. And our growth demonstrates that we are an international city and to some degree an international state in a way that Alabama is years and years and years behind. This is going to further that divide. And look, I want to say this about Roy Moore. I have said on this show time and time again that my issue with Roy Moore isn't what happened 40 years ago. It's what he did on the bench. Because as a conservative, I believe in the rule of law. It is why I am so strong against illegal immigration to the point of making you uncomfortable sometimes, Bill, when I'm talking about it. But I believe in the rule of law, and I believe in it across the board, not just where it suits my purposes. And that's my issue with him. But the people of Alabama have been fully informed about the goods that they are buying. They are entitled to their representation as they see fit in the U.S. Senate. If Roy Moore wins tomorrow with the voters being given all of this information, then the U.S. Senate doesn't need to do an ethics investigation into something that happened in 1978. That's utterly ridiculous. For one thing, we're well past the statute of limitations. There's a reason why we have those laws.
Wait.
Yeah, but I don't think it would be, I don't think that the ethics investigation, to what I understand, I'm sorry to interrupt you, wouldn't be so much about the charges 40 years ago.
As
much as it would be about, is he suitable? Does he comport with the rules and tenure and conduct of a U.S. senator?
And I think that's inappropriate because the voters of Alabama get to choose.
So, Buddy, we got to get out of this, but I want to throw out one scenario. This is my conspiracy theory here. You know, one way that Republicans could handle this, I suppose, and I get there'd be a cost with Republicans in Alabama who vote for him, but I suppose if Doug Moore wins and Republican leaders do what Mitch McConnell has continued to say will happen, there will be an ethics probe, I suppose they could unseat him And I believe that would allow the Republican governor of Alabama to appoint someone to fill his seat until the 2018 elections. And if you're an Alabama Republican who's not a Roy Moore supporter, that might not be a bad scenario.
That will never happen.
Okay.
I think that is just totally out of the question. Incidentally, when I was in Congress, from the time that I worked on the Hill for Richard B. Russell until the time that I left the Congress, you heard rumors about this kind of thing, but the number one and the absolute guy that all the women stayed away from for 50 years was Strom Thurmond. But nothing was ever done. It was general knowledge that he was the groper of the Senate. So this is not something new. This is not something that just happened just recently. But I still maintain that the people of Alabama, I think, have just about had enough.
All right.
It's not just enough to have a good football team.
All right, I want to change the subject because we got a lot more we want to talk about, and we're going to stay on the same general theme. Jim, Georgia legislature, the leaders down there, the Speaker of the House, and presumably the lieutenant governor, although I know Brian's going to offer us an alternative take on this, that we have now appointed a subcommittee to look at how to deal with sexual harassment, new guidelines, that sort of thing, right?
Right, right. There's a body called the Legislative Services Committee that kind of operates the state capitol and during the interim between legislative sessions. And this last week, it was announced that they had put together a 6-member panel on sexual harassment.
3 members of the House, 3 members of the Senate.
Right. It is going to be chaired by Jen Jones, who is the ranking female in the legislature. She's the Speaker pro tem on the House side. There was no female selected from the Senate. Now, Brian will tell you that's a matter of the Speaker selected, who is chairman of the Legislative Services Committee, selected the members. I'm trying to ascertain whether the Senate had made any nominations, but Brian is about to tell us right now the Speaker was very restricted into the members that they could pick.
Brian, we should just say before that Lieutenant Governor Cagle has faced some criticism for not seeing to it that a female member of the Senate was appointed to this. And we should also point out, of course, that you are now beginning to work as a consultant to the Cagle campaign, which doesn't disqualify you from having an opinion, but which is something people need to keep in mind.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm happy to speak on behalf of the campaign when it comes to this. And when you talk about there being an issue raised about there not being a Senate woman appointed to the committee, it's one person making that case, and it is an underdog Democrat candidate for governor, who is looking to get attention and to rally her base. That's what this is about. And that was she was the headline of Jim's story. So she got what she wanted out of all of this. The fact is, Casey Cagle has led in this issue on getting change at the General Assembly. He was one of the forces behind getting this committee together to study this issue. He was part of the leadership to make sure we get a female attorney who is one of the most well-respected attorneys on this sexual harassment issue in the state, who will be advising the committee. So there will be female perspectives.
Right.
Just to the chairman being Jan Jones.
Loretta, let me ask you to weigh in. Here's what I don't get about where Brian's coming from on this. With an issue that is as important right now as sexual harassment, I understand Jim is suggesting there's a structure, this Legislative Affairs Committee. I find it very hard to imagine that the leaders of the Georgia General Assembly, Lieutenant Governor, the Speaker, and others, couldn't figure out a way to equalize the members of a sexual harassment subcommittee, if for nothing else, for appearance sake. But of course, much more than that.
I think it would have been in the best interest of all of those involved, no matter political affiliation, to have had more women on this committee and to have done whatever it took to make that happen. And as far as Stacey Evans is concerned, I think this is a bellwether of what's to come in the gubernatorial race. So she took a shot. And it raises a broader issue that even if the lieutenant governor were able to choose whoever he wanted to sit on that committee, there are only two Republican females in the state Senate.
It raises
a much broader issue here about female representation. One, we are grossly underserved in terms of female representation in the Georgia legislature, not unlike other legislatures across the country and the U.S. Congress itself. And they are woefully underrepresented in leadership. Now, Steve Henson, who has more females within his caucus, could have
the minority leader
could have said, I'm going to have a proxy and I'm going to appoint one of my female members to sit on this committee. Now, I don't know if that's legally doable or not, but certainly he has a number of colleagues to choose from.
And there's the other area that I'm not sure that has been fully explored yet is whether ex officio members can be added to that six-member panel.
I think generally the legislature in a situation like this can do whatever it wants to do.
Well, that was my question.
Always has before. But I need to disclose, I am certainly a Stacey Evans partisan, so I'm not exactly honest broker in this. But let me say this. I served when I was in Congress and the legislature, substituting lots of times as a designee of a chairman of a committee and so forth and so on. And there are ways it could have been done. I think what happened with Casey here, and I happen to like him very much. I just think he didn't think about it and probably wishes he could do this one all over again. And while Steve Henson, I see what Steve Henson has done, but at the same time, if he could do it, then somebody else could bring in their proxy on the Republican side.
Does this in any way, Brian, I'm going to give you a chance, and I'll let you answer, if you wouldn't mind, answer my question. Does this do anything to dispel the notion that the Georgia legislature, like legislatures around the country, is a good old boys club?
Well, to Loretta's point, I think we as a state, not just we as a party, have got to do a better job of getting highly qualified women to run for office, to get them through the primary process, because that's really where the key elections are in Georgia these days for the General Assembly, and then getting them into the House and Senate. Let's make that a priority. As far as the committee goes, I have no problem with what Stacey Evans said over the weekend because it was a cynical political ploy to get attention.
Wait, that's what I do for a living. Okay, of course you do. Why do you need to put Stacey Evans in the equation? Because
she's the one driving this.
Do you really think, okay, Loretta, Brian is suggesting that it's only because of Stacey Evans that women are nervous about this.
Look, to Brian's point, and we're friends. We were, at least when we walked in here. So
you still will.
I'm kidding. To Brian's point, this is politics, right? And so she took a shot. She saw an opening and she took a shot. You know, you can't begrudge her for doing it. But again, I'm going to say we have to date five male candidates in the race for the governor of Georgia, two female candidates on the Democratic side of the House running for the governor of Georgia. To think that this is not going to be a glaring issue in this campaign is just, you would have to be under a rock to not think that this is going to be a huge issue and that it's going to be exploited.
I've got to get a break in. I would be stunned if we don't see Jim Galloway some development in this that somehow allows a couple of more women to be involved in this subcommittee.
We have to wait for Brian to drive to the state capitol first.
All right. Thank you. Look, it's a tough conversation. And Brian, you know, when you said that there are things that you do that upset me, I always like hearing the voices of people out there. It's the listeners who sometimes are a little concerned about you, but that's fine too.
Absolutely. If y'all just want somebody to just sing to the choir, I am not the person to have in. And let me finish with this. Judge the committee by its results.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got one more issue to deal with that is in this whole general area, and that's President Trump. There are suddenly calls for renewing investigative work on those women who've come forward and said that they were victims of sexual harassment from President Trump. We'll do that after this break.
Godless is the new Netflix Western series, built on classic Westerns, but with a twist. It's set in a town run by women because the men died in a mining disaster. It also features a one-armed villain, played by Jeff Daniels, and lots of horses. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer and director Frank Scott. Join us.
Fresh Air, 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Buddy Darden, Loretta Lepore, Brian Robinson, and Jim Galloway are in the Political Rewind studio. So we're talking about sexual harassment, and this morning, Megyn Kelly interviewed three of the women who have come forward in the past when he was a candidate to give them an opportunity to talk about why they think there ought to be a renewed look at the president now's role in possible sexual harassment in the past. Let's just listen to a little of that interview.
What do you want to see happen to him?
I would like to see some reckoning. I would like to see that he's not Teflon and that he acknowledges in some fashion or another and be called to answer to the charges.
Some are calling for a probe, a Senate ethics probe into his behavior. Is that what you want?
I think that's fair. I mean, they were more than willing to do that for Senator Franken. Why is the president immune to that?
Loretta, let's pick up on that last point. Al Franken was, we should point out that Al Franken asked the Senate Ethics Committee to investigate him, but they certainly said they would have if he hadn't decided to resign his seat. So is there a double standard going on here?
Well, I don't know if it's a double standard. I guess with regard to Senator Franken, he was a member of the Senate. He was a member of the body, and it was their responsibility to investigate him, whether he asked for it or not. I would have to cede to Buddy on this, but I don't know that Congress has the authority to explore this in any way with the president.
I think you're correct. In fact, if I were Al Franken, I would not have resigned under the circumstances because he had 3 years left on his term, and he would have had a chance to at least clear his name, because when you resign, then people assume you're automatically guilty. And I regret to see him go. That's his decision, but I do think he should have stuck it out and tried it. Look at what happened to Larry Craig, you know, when he was caught in the men's room in Minnesota or somewhere like that. He weathered the storm, finished his term, didn't run again. I think he probably should have stayed on, at least to let's see how
Jim,
it went.
Jim, you know, it's interesting that the White House now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, says when asked questions about this, look, the voters have already litigated this matter. They've already elected Trump, despite hearing these stories. So it's a dead issue. If Roy Moore wins, we might wonder whether that we're going to hear the same call. But forget about Moore for a minute. What about this notion that voters have already approved of Trump and there's no point in looking at these accusations?
Number one, the question of litigation by electorate, I think, is kind of silly, first of all. And there are forums where this can be brought. I mean, if you remember the impeachment of Bill Clinton, it came as a result of various lawsuits that were filed of him and his actions that occurred elsewhere, and then he ended up lying to in a deposition there. You do have is one of those accusers has filed a slander suit?
Yes, I think. Yes, there is a slander suit.
And I think that's the more likely vehicle or something like it where something like this could play out.
All right, but we don't really think there. Do we think that anything's going to happen here, Loretta?
I don't really know what's going to happen.
All right.
I think Republicans in Washington have a really tough time right now, an uphill battle, and that, you know, a lot of the articles right now, if you read the headlines with regard to Roy Moore and so forth, it's, you know, that Republicans are in jeopardy because they're caught between a rock and a hard place on some of these issues. If they do nothing, it's not good. And if they do something, it's not good. So how they choose to move forward with whether it's the Roy Moore situation or the situation currently now with the president, you know, they have a calculus. They're walking a tightrope on this. And, you know, the saying goes that doing the right thing is the right thing, and in the end, that's the right political thing. But we'll see if that happens.
All right. One other quick. We're only going to have a moment to talk about this because we're running short of time. But we mentioned it at the very start of the show. The Senate continues to try to refine its tax bill, with the House and Senate both looking at what they're going to do to make sure they can get votes after the conference committee reports out to pass this thing. And we see there seems to be increasing concern about the polling, which shows the American people don't like this bill very much at all. But it also could be having a big impact on how Governor Deal, Brian's old boss, works on his budget and how we deal with our income tax next year, right?
That's a good point. That was an excellent article in the AJC yesterday about it.
James Salter, yep.
As Brian knows and all of us know, is that virtually half of the money that the state disperses every year comes through the federal government. This is not to say that Georgia doesn't a good job with its own budget, but when you look at the tremendous amount of money that comes from the federal government as a pass-through from the state, and the state's entire financial structure is based on anticipating this money. So something is going to have to be worked out here and with more certainty than it is. I think, regrettably, and I understand the political need and the necessity in some quarters to pass a tax bill this time, but at the same time, when we passed a tax reform back in 86, we had had hearings at least for a year, and both the legislature and the parties were on the same page. And I think the law of unintended consequences scares the average person. It's you'd rather deal with the devil you know than the devil you don't know. And it's the uncertainty that's out there because people just don't know what's in the bill.
All right. Jim, we're going to have to watch and see how this plays out for all of us.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you what, you know, as a junior member of the senior society in America, the ability to deduct medical expenses, it's present in the Senate bill, not in the House bill.
Yep.
That is, to me, that's going to be a deal breaker right there.
Yeah. Well, you also have to wonder, you've got the Speaker of the House, you've got Paul Ryan, who is already now saying, well, you know, if we start running into deficits that are too overwhelming, we can always cut Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, that's the sort of talk that will have some impact.
And quite frankly, this is what happens between Democratic administrations and Republican ones. In Democratic administrations, if you're a Republican, deficits are just simply bad because they're deficits. If you're in a Republican administration, deficits become good because they force you to look at reductions in social spending.
But if you go back to the beginning about your initial point about the state budget, the problem there is that you don't have a deficit. You know, you have to balance, constitutionally obligated to balance the budget. And back in 2010, after the recession, when the state was coming up short on Medicaid money, they had to actually recess for a week and wait for the federal government to act before they could go back to work to pass the budget.
Buddy, you got the last word on this.
Well, the scary thing right now is we're coming up into a budget deal which, by all accounts, is going to add $100 billion, including about two-thirds of it for military, to the current caps already. So on the one hand, we're saying we're going to spend $100 billion more, and at the same time, we're going into debt another $1.5 trillion because of the tax bill.
All right. Jim Galloway on Friday's show, the show that you and I soldiered through alone, sparing everybody else.
As the blizzard fell around our ears.
We promised that we were going to let people know about your recommendations, four books for possible Christmas, Hanukkah gifts, whatever. We got about enough time to mention the titles of each book.
Okay.
We'll post them online for our...
All right. Okay. First one is The Best President the Nation Never Had. It's a personal memoir of working with Sam Nunn by one of his top staffers.
Roland McElroy.
McElroy, yes. He was one of my first bosses when I was an intern there. Citizen Newt, by Craig Shirley. It looks like to be the first installment of a series of biographical books on him. This is the easy part. This is from his beginnings to his ascension as U.S. Speaker. The next couple of volumes are going to be a little bit harder. Then you have Play It Again, Sam, The Notable Life of Sam Misselle, Atlanta's first minority mayor. Which was it kind of fits into the backgrounding of this last fight. And then you have $10 to Hate. It's a Texas book. But the neat part about it is that the first chapters are devoted to the revival of to the history of the revival of the Klan, which occurred in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And the brains behind the outfit was a brothel keeper named Bessie Tyler.
Happened after the Leo Frank case, after Leo Frank was lynched and the Klan rejuvenated itself on Stone Mountain. That's where they rallied in those days. So, Jim, we will put those books up on the Political Rewind website, which you can get to by going to gpbnews.org and then find Political Rewind in one of the pull-down menus, and you'll be able to get there. One other quick note. Before we leave you, Tom Faust found a fascinating, and I'll leave it to you to decide how to characterize it. The Hill moved a story just a little while ago. A pro-Trump super PAC arranged for a 12-year-old girl to interview Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore as he faces mounting allegations of sexual misconduct with teenage girls. The America First Project brought Millie March, a girl whose interviews during the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, went viral to Alabama to interview Moore. So young Millie March being used to inoculate Roy Moore.
Let us assume
charges.
There was parental supervision.
All right. I mean, there's not much more we can say after that, except thank you to Buddy Darden, Loretta Lepore, Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway for really interesting conversation today. Thanks so much for being with us. And my thanks to Olivia Rheingold, Tom Faust, and Tyler Morris for being the brains behind this operation. Couple things before we leave you today. Wednesday, we'll be doing a live sit-down with Speaker of the House David Ralston. We're looking forward to talking to the Speaker about what's happening in the upcoming legislative session. And then on Thursday, on Two-Way Street, I just want to call it to your attention now. Christian Bush, who was for years part of Sugarland, the duo Sugarland with Jennifer Nettles, one of the most popular acts in country music, they have reunited. And Christian comes into the Two-Way Street studio to do his annual Christmas show with us. He shares Christmas music, talks about the Sugarland comeback, and a lot more. That's Thursday at 2 o'clock. And, of course, we'll be here at 2 on Wednesday and 3 on Friday for Political Rewind. So we'll see you all throughout the week. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great evening.